May it please the court. My name is Steve Ravel, and I'm going to spend a few minutes arguing to you that an unbroken line of statutory construction cases from the Supreme Court and four different circuits hold that EPA's no notice, no hearing December 7th order should not give the EPA a pleading or a proof break in the pending enforcement action before Judge Ferguson in the Northern District. Further, I'm going to argue that Section 1431 of the Safe Drinking Water Act is unconstitutional as applied by EPA to Range in this case, both as a violation of due process and as an unlawful delegation. When I sit down, my friend and colleague John Riley will explain why, even if constitutional, the order is arbitrary and capricious and cannot withstand your scrutiny. After disclosing its intentions to both the Dallas media and the environmental lobby, EPA, without notice or hearing, faxed a writing to my client that it characterized as an order, but that most courts have characterized as a pleading more in the nature of a complaint. By this writing's terms, EPA ordered Range to study and presumably later to remediate a swath of territory that begins in southern Oklahoma, cuts a wide swath through the center of Texas, and ends at the Rio Grande just north of Del Rio. That remediation, and likely subsequent remediation, had nothing to do with any emergency, is not necessary to the immediate protection of people or property, and Judge Ferguson so concluded in his June 20th order, where he stayed the enforcement action brought against my client, stayed the accrual of penalties during the pendency of his stay, and made an express conclusion that no individuals are in any immediate danger because the government admitted as such to him in open court. He reached out to this court by that order for guidance concerning whether EPA's our ex parte conclusions substitute for proof in a later Article III enforcement action passes muster, either constitutionally or otherwise. By its enforcement action, EPA seeks to collect $50,000 a day in penalties and claims that the federal district court must mandatorily enter three mandatory injunctions, all that are investigatory, none that are prohibitory, none that have anything to do with explosive houses or benzene, all without pleading or proof of anything beyond failure to comply with the unilaterally issued executive branch order. And in the
You say the district judge reached out to this court?
Yes, the district judge.
Did you reach out to this court as well?
I reached out to this court as well to answer the questions that he posed, and I asked this court to
You didn't file an action, though.
Pardon?
You didn't file an action here in this court.
Yes, we filed an action in this court. The congressionally mandated action that says within 45 days of one of these orders, we either have to bring it to you or not have it judicially reviewed ever.
You brought an original action in this court.
We brought an original action in this court that asked you to conclude, as the 11th Circuit did in TVA, that their action isn't final and you don't have jurisdiction to consider it either under the Bennett test or because it treats our client unconstitutionally.
Help me understand. Now, you file an action here, and you're arguing that we don't have jurisdiction to hear the action you file. Is that your argument?
Our argument is that it was too big a risk under TVA not to come here at all. We needed to point out to you either that it wasn't final and you couldn't review it, or get arbitrary and capricious review, or the risk was just too great that those conclusions would be irrebuttably presumed against us in the enforcement action that they filed about the same time we came here. Turning back to the statutory construction non-constitutional argument, the Supreme Court in ADIC, the Seventh Circuit in Wausau, the Ninth Circuit in Sackett, the 11th Circuit in Red Wing, and the D.C. Circuit in Kelly have all dealt with what is EPA's pleading and proof burden in a later enforcement action. And those five courts, the Supreme Court and four circuits, have unanimously concluded that they are put to their pleading in proof of either an underlying statutory violation, a breach of some legal duty, and that my client contamination occurred, which Mr. Riley will take the position didn't, or at least that our client caused or contributed that contribution. The DOJ lawyer who argued Sackett in the Ninth Circuit told that court she wouldn't want to live in a world where the rule was any different. And here in
was
this
Sackett court, under the Clean Water Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act?
Sackett was under the Clean Water Act, but the essentials are the same.
Well, but we're here under the Safe Drinking Water
Act. We're under the Safe Drinking Water Act, but the provisions
and there are some differences, aren't
there? There are some differences, but in Sackett, the essential fact pattern was the same. A no-notice order with that allegedly added new obligations and a substitute for proof, but in the cert grant in Sackett and in Sackett, the question is, do they get pre-process, pre-order due process? We're asking for less. All we're asking is after the order and before the federal district court enforces it, we get process. We're asking for the thing that the government conceded was true in Sackett.
Under a different statute.
Under a different statute, but where the essentials are the same. Notice process and sort of an irrebuttable presumption and not an opportunity to rebut that presumption.
Well, but essentially under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the EPA is authorized to do exactly what it did in this case, isn't it? They sent your client a notice about an enforcement action. And then when you fail to comply, they file an action in district court.
Right.
Isn't that what the statute provides?
That's what the statute provides, but the question is, and where they're differing from the jurisprudence everywhere else, is whether their conclusions are irrebuttably presumed in that action. What they did was fine, and there could be circumstances where it would have been proper, but the use to which they're putting it is the constitutionally repugnant thing, and that's what TVA held. Under the Clean Air Act in TVA, again, the essentials were the same. On any information statute, low standard, and an attempt to parlay those executive branch conclusions into a substitute for testable, meetable courtroom proof. All Range is asking for is, after the order, a chance to defend, like you would defend any public nuisance lawsuit. Was there contamination? Did we cause it? We're asking for only that before before $50,000 a day in penalties can be assessed and we can be mandated to, I analogize it to a commercial case for an accounting. They want us to study the big hunk of Texas. And they say perhaps we don't want them to remediate it, but that's like suing for an accounting and not asking for the money.
Did the Railroad Commission agree with you?
100%.
And they just ignored the Railroad Commission even though the statute says they're supposed to take it into account?
Candidly, Judge, the Railroad Commission administrative hearing with full evidence was after December 7th. Mr. Riley will give you a little bit more timeline information about the EPA Railroad Commission interaction before December 7th, but he will be spending a fair amount of time making that point that the EPA was not sufficiently deferential to the Railroad Commission.
I think your time is up.
I think my time is up.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is John Riley, and I will present the portion of our argument related to the review under the Administrative Procedures Act. EPA's order and the selectively chosen administrative record are insufficient to establish a rational basis for EPA's action in this matter. EPA has not established that there was a risk of endangerment at the time that the order was issued, much less that Range caused or contributed to that risk. EPA's overbroad and open-ended ordering provisions do not address even the risk that it perceives.
When does EPA envision you having the chance to bring forth your evidence that there's no contamination?
But EPA's position is that it's largely irrelevant whether Range caused or contributed to the contamination that it perceives existing.
But you have to pay daily fines?
Yes, ma'am.
Why isn't that quintessential deprivation of due process without hearing? Sorry, that's probably a question for your colleague that just sat down.
But I'm at least studied enough on that issue to agree with you that it certainly would be that if no fault needs to be proven at any time by EPA, to subject Range to fines is a constitutional deprivation.
But, counsel, there is a provision where if you get an enforcement order from EPA with which you disagree,
Yes, sir.
There is a process whereby you can object to that order, isn't it?
This is the process. It is an arbitrary and capricious review according to Section 1448.
Well, but you're claiming we don't have jurisdiction to hear anything that you filed the action asking us to hear.
I think the most instructive opinion of the opinions we've cited is the TVA case, which is a Clean Air Act case, admittedly. But the TVA court was particularly concerned that the standard under statute for issuance of a 1431 order is whether there's any information. And they refer to and give some hypotheticals of an anonymous phone call.
Let me just understand. Are you conceding that we have jurisdiction to,
no, sir,
to hear this?
No, sir. We are conceding that under EPA's interpretation and on the
where
basis
should it, where should it be heard?
If it's going to
you
be
heard, want an opportunity to be heard.
Yes, sir.
And I guess I'm asking you, if it's not here, where?
It would be in the Northern District then, and EPA would be required to prove that Range caused or contributed to some contamination or at least had a nexus to the perceived risk that EPA acted upon.
And that's been an action different from the enforcement action that they filed already.
Well, according to Judge Ferguson, what Judge Ferguson feels is that he is limited to simply a sentencing hearing, effectively, that all he would be able to do is determine whether the order was issued and whether Range complied and then assess a penalty. Again, according to the EPA's reading of the statutes in Section 1431 and 1448.
Do we have jurisdiction to tell him what his powers and scope of his review is?
I think you have jurisdiction to tell EPA that it has misinterpreted Section 1431 and its authority. And I think that would compel the result in the Northern District that EPA would then have to prove at least that Range had done something that warranted the EPA's direction to EPA. A direction to Range to remediate, as Mr. Ravel said in its
and
most.
I am trying to comprehend how we'd have jurisdiction to do that, but we don't have jurisdiction to do what else?
I think it would be implied by your remand and vacature of the order, or your vacature and remand of this order, that it would say that EPA cannot simply rely on any information as reaching the level of finality that would.
So we have some limited jurisdiction?
Well, I think you have jurisdiction. Jurisdiction the way the TVA court did, where it found that after review of the statute, that in order to interpret the statute in a way that gave the court jurisdiction resulted in an unconstitutional statute. And so they reviewed the statute and said the way Congress must have intended this then can't be the way it's literally written. So they determined that the order did not have the force of law, and they remanded the case back to EPA for further proceedings, which is what we're asking you to do in this case. The mention was made of the proceeding before the Railroad Commission, which, as Mr. Ravel pointed out, did occur after the issuance of the order. So in December 7, 2010, EPA issued its order. But it is a necessary predicate to EPA's issuance of a 1431 order that it satisfied or it determined that there was insufficient action by the state and local authorities. EPA determined that the Railroad Commission, which was still investigating, I don't believe this point is disputed, was still investigating the matter, that investigation was insufficient as far as EPA saw it to address what it perceived as imminent and substantial risk. The interesting portion of that, I think, is if you look at the order and its ordering provisions, what the ordering provisions compel is an investigation. So I think there's a paradox there, that if EPA feels as though 1431 requires an investigation, or the 1431 order required Range to conduct an investigation, it also feels that an investigation was insufficient state and local action. That's what it has to find in order to, for the 1431 order to stand. This court in Bell Petroleum pointed out that, specifically with respect to a maximum contaminant level, that an indication or a sample that is over a maximum contaminant level is not a presumption of risk of harm. In Bell Petroleum, there was similar evidence in the sense that there was indication of an exceedance of maximum contaminant level. This court held that maximum contaminant levels contemplate lifetime exposure, and that a simple or one-time event was not indicative or sufficient to prove risk of harm. As it pertains to natural gas, there are two issues that EPA cites that have created the risk of harm. One is the benzene concentration being over a maximum contaminant level and based on an August 17th sample, which when EPA sampled itself in October, it found that the constituent benzene in domestic water well number one was below protective levels. In other words, the water was safe to drink. The other issue EPA cites as creating a risk of harm is natural gas contamination or intrusion into domestic water wells, but admits, and indeed touts the testimony of Mr. Blevins, saying that natural gas intrusion into domestic water wells is a common occurrence, or into water wells is a common occurrence. So the, in addition to that, also, when Range supplemented the record and brought to your attention the Department of Interior opinion on what constitutes a risk for purposes of natural gas in domestic water wells, the levels monitored by EPA or measured by EPA in a single event were below what the Department of Interior thought of as necessary to address. There's a Department of Interior, it's not quite a standard, but it's an advisory that says if you're between 10,000 and 28,000, then you may want to address the situation or look into the situation, primarily by venting the well. But the EPA top measurement, or highest measurement, domestic water well number one, was 20,000 micrograms per liter. So the point being that there wasn't, even based on EPA's own sampling, a risk of harm at that time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Link. I'm from the Department of Justice. With me at council table is Tina Arnold from the Environmental Protection Agency, Region 6. I'd like to start by clarifying a couple of the issues that go to the due process challenges in this case, and I think these clarifications are important. First of all, with respect to statutory nexus, in this case, we do have an order in which EPA concluded that Range caused or contributed to the endangerment that EPA identified. Now, when we filed our brief, we responded to what we perceived to be Range's argument that only where EPA finds that a recipient has caused or contributed may it issue an order under Section 1431. And we pointed out in response, citing the Trinity case from the Fourth Circuit, that the plain text of the statute only imposes that limitation on orders to provide alternative water supplies, and it appears to be silent as to precisely what are the constraints on EPA's authority elsewhere. Now, this is not
We've
a case.
We've applied the Trinity case in this circuit, have we, counsel?
No, and I would also concede that Trinity, because it found that the record showed that that recipient caused or contributed, frankly, did not reach the issue of what lesser nexus, if any, applies to other types of orders in other factual circumstances. Here, EPA ultimately did not stake out a position, did not define, did not I give a Chevron 2 interpretation of the statute that defined what lesser nexus it might have relied on had it not reached that first conclusion that Range caused or contributed. So we will clarify and acknowledge here that while we believe that conclusion was rational based on the record and should be upheld, if the court disagreed that there was an adequate record basis for it, it would have to remand the order.
Do you believe we have jurisdiction to hear this case today?
We do. The district court judge evaluated that issue and decided that these orders meet both prong one and prong two of the Bennett versus Spear standard. We think the district court's analysis was correct in that regard.
If it's not, if it's rational, then tell me where in the record it shows a risk of imminent harm that would justify the emergency action. As I understand, the water wells had already been shut down. The Railroad Commission says it's no risk of imminent harm, and the levels are not such that would be deemed imminent even under your own guidelines.
I would refer the court to the Department of Interior guidance, which both parties have accepted is relevant here. And that guidance says, and it refers to thresholds of 10 milligrams per liter and 28 milligrams per liter. Above 28 milligrams per liter, you're at the point where an explosion could occur. But the guidance also indicates that owners of wells with methane greater than 10 milligrams, and here, by the way, the sample EPA took showed 20, owners of wells with concentrations greater than 10 milligrams might also wish to contact the local county health department for further assistance and consider removing ignition sources from
the
immediate area.
What is the amount that you found here?
EPA, in the joint inspection and sampling that it conducted with the Railroad Commission in October of 2010, found a level of over 20 milligrams per liter in domestic well number one.
Which is out of service, is that correct? And
that,
has been out of service.
That well is currently out of service.
So no one's getting drinking water from that well.
There is still the potential. That is true. It is out of service in part because EPA advised the homeowner that he may wish to do that. Advised also the owner of domestic well number two that he may wish to do that. But nonetheless, without anyone taking further action to investigate why the methane impacts are occurring and whether something needs to be done to alleviate the problem, there is still an ongoing risk.
But an ongoing risk is not an imminent threat justifying emergency action, though, is it?
Under this standard, under this statute, because it uses the phrase may present an imminent and substantial endangerment, yes, it can be, and EPA rationally explained why under this statute. There are some statutes that impose a stricter burden for taking action. This one errs on the side of precaution, and Congress in the legislative history explained that it wanted those terms to be construed to give the paramount importance and priority to protection of public health. I would also note the Massachusetts versus EPA decision, which interpreted that same phrase, imminent, may present an imminent and substantial endangerment under another statute.
Does the statute also require you to contact the Railroad Commission before taking action?
EPA
explicitly.
Did that. EPA did that here. They were in contact with the Railroad Commission as early as August, 4 months before the order was issued.
And did the Railroad Commission advise you that it was not any kind of imminent threat?
The Railroad Commission did not agree with EPA as of December that this was an emergency and that there was a need to act. However, EPA had its own decision to make under the statute. It was not, the statute doesn't say it shall defer. It says it shall consult with the state agency and shall determine if the state agency has acted to protect health. But it is EPA's decision to make as to whether it finds conditions that may present an imminent and substantial endangerment. And if it does, it needs to act. And that's
when
what
is it
here.
Your understanding that the your opposing counsel would have an opportunity to challenge any fines or things? When would their due process take place?
I actually think that they have four categories of process in this case, and I want to be, that's another thing I want to clarify. To begin with, and keeping in mind that at the administrative level, when the due process case law refers to an opportunity for a hearing, it does not necessarily mean trial type hearings. And there are plenty of cases recognizing that even informal meet and confers can qualify. For example, U.S. v. Valentine, which both parties have relied on as an instructive case in the RCRA enforcement context. So, keeping that in mind, before the order was issued, and the record documents this, EPA tried to set up a meeting with Range, offered them the chance to come and confer with EPA and present information. I would refer you to pages 218 and 251 of the joint appendix, which both make reference to this. Range did not avail themselves of this opportunity to present data to EPA at that time. After the order was issued, the order on its last paragraph said that, again, Range was invited to meet and confer with EPA to discuss both the terms and applicability of the order. And I think that word applicability clearly encompasses Range's position that, hey, you've got the wrong guy.
So
they did not avail themselves of that opportunity.
You're saying those are the due process?
No, I'm saying that is only the beginning. They have the opportunity.
I'm asking when is their due process, when did they have a chance to talk with people who are not neutral but who are prosecuting against them?
Well, I think the part of that question that goes to is, was this something issued without any chance to present information to the EPA? No, it was not. That is incorrect. They had the chance. They didn't take it. However, they then get two judicial hearings. They get arbitrary and capricious review in this court, which both the Hodel case, the Supreme Court, and the Fifth Circuit in Woods have held.
Is this a hearing right now?
This is a hearing because you have
arbitrary and capricious review that you are talking about.
Arbitrary and capricious review of whether EPA explained its decision, whether it considered the relevant factors under this statute, and whether the findings that it made, that the circumstances may present an imminent substantial endangerment, that Range caused or contributed, that the relief is necessary, that the state did not act, whether those findings are rational based on the record and EPA's explanation. You have the power and the jurisdiction to decide that. And if you are not convinced that there is a rational basis in the record, you can remand the order. And that type of review was conducted both in Hodel and was conducted in Woods and was deemed adequate to protect the minimal constitutional guarantee of due process in the context of an emergency administrative action. And keep in mind,
since we're reviewing facts here, I want to make sure I understand these facts. We're talking about drinking water.
Yes.
And hadn't a determination been made that it was unsafe to the point that some people, where wells were capped, were having to resort to alternative means for drinking water. I don't know whether that was having
that is
water,
correct.
Bottled water brought in, and I don't know how they were flushing toilets, but...
Well, there was a point where the owner, Mr. Lipsky, the owner of well number one, was paying to supply his own water. He happens to be someone with the financial means to do that. I can imagine many other circumstances where the homeowner wouldn't have had the same financial means to do that. Now, that was before EPA, of course, ordered Range.
And aren't there some 20 counties involved?
Well, no, I think that based on the findings in the order, it's clear what areas we're really talking about that EPA is concerned. It certainly, as part of the relief in the order, asked Range to survey domestic wells in a 3,000-foot radius. It wanted to find out, does this threat extend any farther than the two wells we know about? We need to get that information.
But do the gas lines run through a significant number of counties?
You know, my knowledge is limited on exactly the full extent of Range's gas lines. Again, had Range taken the opportunities it was given to present information to EPA, both before the order was issued and immediately afterward, EPA might have had more information on that itself. Now, I also want to clarify the fourth part of due process that they are given under the facts of this case and the second judicial hearing. That's the district court. And to be clear, and we said this in our brief, that court, as to civil penalty, has the discretion not to enter a penalty if it is not convinced that it should equitably do so. There are cases, and we've not cited these in our brief, but there are cases that have defined the factors that would be considered typically in deciding whether to assess a penalty, and the government in past in other safe drinking water cases has argued a list of those factors. Seriousness.
Well, they could ask Judge Ferguson to not issue a penalty, and that would be their due process. Is that what you're saying?
That would be part of their due process, because due process is concerned with whether you get a fair hearing before you're deprived of property, deprived of liberty.
Okay, investigatory order? When do they get process on that? Is that this arbitrary and capricious review that we're doing now?
Well, I would submit I would submit that the only way they're deprived of property is if they have to pay a penalty or if they are forced by a court to perform the order. And they can convince, and the district court has the discretion to make the decision to do neither of those things, in which case they will never have been deprived of property. And they've told us in their briefs that any money they spent on investigation themselves has been done voluntarily. So we can't consider that a deprivation if they've done it voluntarily.
No, but if I thought that you were asking Judge Ferguson to issue some further investigatory order. Am I wrong on that?
We have sought enforcement of the last three paragraphs of paragraph 50F in the order. The judge is going to decide whether to enter an injunction. We are not suggesting that judge automatically is constrained to enter an injunction if he finds that they did not comply with the order. One reason we are not making that argument is because this court in the Fifth Circuit in Marine Shales, U.S. versus Marine Shale Processors, and I'll give you the cite for that, 81 F3rd, at 1359 to 60 in 1996, rejected a government argument that an injunction in a similar enforcement context was automatic. This was under RCRA, and the court said, while the balance of equities may be different in the enforcement context than it is in a typical private party case for injunctive relief, there is still some measure of discretion inherent in the court that is considering whether to enter an injunction unless the statute expressly indicates otherwise.
So is it your position that they can argue in front of Judge Ferguson that there was no emergency, that we didn't cause it, and therefore we don't have to do any of this, and also this investigation that you want us to do doesn't go to the whatever the problem was and it's too overburdensome? Can they argue all of that full range, or can they only argue that it's overburdensome and you've already taken away the first two levels of attack, that it was no emergency and they didn't cause it?
Under 42 U.S.C. 1448, the judicial review provision, they can't make a facial attack on the validity of the order as issued. But since a permanent injunction is something prospective going forward, there is simply no question in our minds that the district judge is going to evaluate what are the circumstances now. Because how could he know whether the injunction is necessary to respond to public health unless he's aware of what the evidence shows today regarding the ongoing conditions?
Him.
And the second part of your question, it seems to me Range obviously has collected information since the order was issued. Now, they didn't provide it to EPA until very recently. They did it under the auspices of the state. But the judge would have the discretion to consider equitably whether they should be deemed to have substantially complied with this order under the circumstances. We don't necessarily agree,
legally,
but they would have that discretion.
What about the legal validity of the order, not just the equitable enforcement of the order.
I think the legal validity of the order must be decided by this court in this proceeding.
He can't decide that in the further review of whether to enforce the injunctive relief that, I mean, that you seek?
No, that would not be before the district court judge, but he has the discretion because as to penalty, the statute says may be assessed. So obviously, he may not assess a penalty. And as to an injunction under Marine Shales, he would have equitable discretion, some measure of equitable discretion in the as to whether an injunction needs to be entered.
Why does he think he doesn't have the authority to do that? They just said, and I understood that Judge Ferguson has taken the position that he has to pretty much automatically rubber stamp the thing. Well, and isn't that because y'all told him that? He didn't just dream that up. Explain to me why you have a different position today than what Judge Ferguson seems to understand.
First of all, I'd say two things. One, we haven't fully briefed what factors should be considered under penalty and injunction in the district court. Parties have had one motion to dismiss to which we responded. They haven't had the chance to fully brief how relief should be accorded and under what considerations. And second, to the extent that anything in the argument before the court suggested that an injunction was automatic, I'm simply saying that we recognize the precedent in Marine Shales. Neither of the briefs in this case had gone to the level of detail of specifically citing authorities governing the nature of injunctive relief, in part because we, of course, weren't at that point. We were still litigating the question of whether the order is valid at all. But I'm going to refer the court to the Marine Shales precedent. I think that that's going to control on that question.
And
I think under that precedent.
Forgive me for wanting to get back to facts, but tell me why you consider this an emergency. Why did the EPA consider this an emergency?
In the EPA's view, methane, not only the presence of methane, but the fact that it was increasing at the time based on its samples, again, had reached in domestic well number one a level twice the threshold at which the DOI guidance suggests you may want to call the authorities and get your ignition sources away from the well. That under
methane.
Those conditions.
You said ignition, so you're talking about something that's
something
explosive?
Could contribute to an explosion, be the catalyst for an explosion. Under those circumstances, there was a risk of harm, and it was not prudent to sit and wait and see if the levels got even higher before beginning to take action. And one reason it wouldn't have been prudent is, and I'll refer back to what Congress said when it passed this statute and explained in the legislative history how it wanted it to be implemented. It said, while the risk of harm must be imminent, the harm itself need not be. And administrative and judicial implementation of this authority must take place early enough to prevent the potential hazard from materializing. EPA.
What are you reading from? I'm sorry, Counselor.
I'm reading a quotation from the legislative history, but you can find it in the addendum to our brief. And where I was reading was addendum page 63 to EPA's brief.
And prior to taking any action in this case, to what extent did the Environmental Protection Agency consult with any state or local authority?
The record here, the joint appendix, will show that EPA was in contact with the state as early as August of 2010. That's 4 months before the order was issued. For example, there is a record of phone conversation with the state agency, the Railroad Commission, in joint appendix page 291, dated August 17th. In October, those agencies did a joint inspection and sampling of both Ranges wells and the domestic wells that were of concern. And there was obviously communication and coordination between the Railroad Commission and EPA from August leading up to December. And before EPA issued the order, it did advise the state that it was preparing to do that and got the state's views on that subject. And yes, the state did say, we don't think it's time to act, and we don't think there's an emergency right now. They disagreed. EPA reached a different conclusion. EPA felt that in carrying out its responsibilities under Section 1431, it needed to act.
So you had August and then September and then October. Is that when you went out?
And by the way,
and did the inspection in October for the first time? Had you done an inspection in August?
The first EPA inspection of the wells that I am aware of is in October of 2010, joint inspection with, I take that back. I'm pretty sure EPA had inspected the domestic wells prior to that date, but in terms of when they inspected Ranges wells and took a sample at Ranges wells, I believe that was in October, and that was done jointly with the Railroad Commission, and I believe that Range had at least a contractor representative there at the time as well.
Was there anything else you wanted to tell us about the how EPA determined an emergency is?
Well, I would like to say just a couple of points on that. One is specifically on the cause or contribute finding. You know, no one suggesting it, or at least no one I think could credibly suggest it was unreasonable to initially look at Range, because that's who the Railroad Commission was looking at. It was the only gas producer in this vicinity. In terms of the samples that EPA took jointly with the Railroad Commission in October at Range's well and Domestic Well 1, no one suggested that there was a problem with those samples, how they were taken, or that there was a problem with the methodologies that were used to compare them to determine if they might be from the same source, isotopic analysis, compositional analysis, both long accepted methodologies in this industry. And when you look at what, and EPA looked at experts inside and outside the agency to evaluate the results of those analyses. Again, no one's questioned their credentials, so that they had the experience. And when you look at what they said, Mr. Coleman, the outside expert, Joint Appendix 148, says the isotopic signatures being as close as they are indicates that they are likely to be from the same source, given the proximity of the production well and the water well. He said a lot more than just, hey, these are both thermogenic gas samples. Dr. Beek, the inside expert, EPA expert, says the isotope data for the Lipsky well and production well look to be identical. The gas composition is similar, and the compositional changes are what one might expect for a gas that has migrated from the production well to the Lipsky well. So, and that's Joint Appendix 297. So these are the opinions EPA had in front of it, and that was certainly a rational basis to conclude that Range caused or contributed, even if it was not 100% certainty. Statute does not require 100% certainty. For all these reasons, Your Honor should uphold the order as rational and reject the due process challenges. Thank you.
Mr. Link points out that no one questions the credentials of the experts that EPA relied upon. In fact, did not follow their advice, but EPA just cited to you. Of course, we've had no opportunity to question those experts. We've had no opportunity to examine their qualifications or their opinions. What we have are sheets of paper in EPA's hand-selected record that give accounts of telephone conversations with those experts as opposed to true opinions. And even with that, the experts' opinions are that the results of EPA's testing are inconclusive. In other
words, what about his position that you can do it either now, or either we can... I don't know how that would occur here in the Court of Appeals under the arbitrary and capricious determination of if it's rational or not that we would go through, because there's not been a time where they've been cross-examined, but that you can do it later before any actual enforcement orders entered into by Judge Ferguson.
If that's true, that's a novel approach and one that I have not seen reported in any case law.
Isn't that what we've just been told?
Yes, I believe that's what you've just been told, is that effectively we can challenge the order in front of Judge Ferguson, the order which concludes that Range caused or contributed to contamination. Apparently we can challenge that. I'm unclear, frankly, as to who would bear that burden. I don't know of any procedure where we would be allowed that opportunity, but it would seem to me in a normal enforcement process, it wouldn't just seem to me, it is the fact, that EPA bears the burden of proof in an enforcement action and would have to go forward before Range would have to respond. I'd like to address a few things Mr. Link brought up. One is the meet and confer process that Mr. Link said Range did not avail itself of. As it turns out, EPA does not have administrative search authority for injection wells under the Safe Drinking Water Act. But Range cooperated with EPA, allowed it access to the site, and in every instance where EPA asked Range for whether Range would cooperate, EPA was granted access. EPA was notified Range at about 4 in the afternoon before it issued its, right after a press conference and before it issued its emergency order. The notion that Range had an opportunity to meet and confer with EPA prior to issuance of the order is simply inaccurate. There had been some notions of sharing information, and Range had done that. The second piece is that after issuance, that Mr. Link says constitutes due process, Range was offered an opportunity to meet and confer, and Range took that opportunity and was told effectively at that meeting that there would be no reconsideration of the order and Range should comply. The order itself sets very tight timelines, as you all realize. Specifically, it says within 24 hours, you must inform the EPA whether you're going to comply fully with the order or not. And then it sets additional 48 hours, 5 days, I believe 15 days and 60 days, all of which Range was supposed to accomplish as provided by the order. The difficulty here is, of course, the construction of Section 1448, which says that the orders, if they are final agency action, are reviewable in this court if they're final agency action. The proper construction, we say, of the statute based on all the case law that Mr. Rabl has cited, specifically TVA, we believe that they are not final agency action, which this court can at least take jurisdiction to determine it doesn't have jurisdiction.
Did it say on the face of the order that it was final?
It did. And it's in fact, I believe all of their orders say similar things. But EPA's representation that it's final agency action is not the test. It is the test under Bennett. The court must evaluate as to whether the EPA really reached a point of finality. And then
does this order meet any of the factors of the Bennett test?
Well, the EPA purports that it does. It says it's the culmination of agency thinking, although all that it asks the Range to do is investigate. It doesn't seem, as testified to by Mr. Blevins in his deposition, EPA has effectively withdrawn the conclusion it reaches in its order that Range caused or contributed. Mr. Blevins testified that it may be that Range caused or contributed. So at least EPA, on its own admission, has invalidated probably the most important provision under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is the provision of alternate water supply by someone who caused or contributed. That's one that's specifically provided for its statute.
I'm sorry. This Trinity Aquifer was a source of drinking water, I think. And I said earlier about some 20 Texas counties. Is that what it was?
Yes, sir. It's in the order, it's actually 55 counties,
and these
but the order says 20.
That they just talked about were testifying about this methane being found in at least these two wells.
Yes, sir.
Were drawing from this Trinity Aquifer, which affected some 20 counties.
Right. Well, what they've said, though.
And
that's
despite
not,
their opinion, you don't think it was prudent for the EPA to take some action when it did?
Well, the EPA's action is predicated on Range's cause or contribution. Range, the wells that we're talking about, went into operation in August 2009. Natural gas in the Trinity Aquifer in water wells is dated, based on the record, dates back to the 90s and before, even before there was production out of the Barnett Shale. So natural gas, as admitted by EPA, in water wells is a common occurrence in this area, and that's resulting from a higher stratum known as the Strawn Formation, where natural gas is naturally occurring. So the point being that natural gas in water wells is not necessarily the result of any human activity. It is a result of geology, which EPA specifically did not study, did not evaluate, in spite of its experts' instructions to do so. See, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.